Hello, everyone. This is your host, Manoj Tandon. Welcome to another episode of Dark Rhino Security, Security Confidential. Today, we have another awesome guest gracing us on the show, Mr. Brian Vallelunga. Brian is the CEO of Doppler. Very interesting name for a company. He is a serial entrepreneur. And he has a ton of experience under his belt with success and, in his own words, failure on some of the research that we've been able to do about him. And, you know, his past stems from Uber, a big name in the industry, and he is a success branching out. So we're grateful you're here, Brian.
Happy to be here. How should we get started?
Oh, well, you know what? Everybody loves the origin story, so we're obligated. So we're going to do that. We want to know how you go from Uber to you've done this. Doppler is not your first startup. You've done a couple
of
these.
Yeah, it's definitely not.
It's definitely not. And so how does this begin? Where's the Big Bang happen? And then what went right with it? What went wrong with it? If you want to, and then we'll get to Doppler here, you know, as to what's going on.
Yeah, sure. So Doppler is startup number 8. There has been many failed attempts to build a successful company. And I've always wanted to build a successful company since I was very little. Like, I mean, you could ask my parents and they would say when I was in like middle school, I was talking about this. I've just been very obsessed with this one thing for a very long period of time. And I actually was working on a startup in college and it wasn't going that well. And it was heading to summertime and I needed an internship and I applied to Uber and I got in. And so while I was at Uber, I was actually working on, as an intern, I was working on my side project while also working at Uber at the same time. Fast forward a little bit, I had a kind of crazy career at Uber. If anyone's like kind of like knows the history of Chris Sacca, who's like an investor, he had a kind of crazy career at Google. And one of the things he did that I really loved and I started doing the same was just attending any meeting I could. And so Uber had like an open door policy, which meant if there was a meeting with the CEO and a bunch of VPs, if it wasn't explicitly closed door, you could join it. And I started doing that as an intern. And they started noticing and gave me bigger and bigger projects. And at one point, fast forward a bit, my manager comes up to me. He's like, "Hey, a lot of engineers are kind of upset because they're reporting into you as an intern right now, and that's not cool for anyone." And so they kind of gave me an ultimatum in a way: drop out of school or go and join full time. And I did. I dropped out of school for the second time and joined Uber full time. And while I was at Uber, I was still working on this side project. And the side project was kind of like all the buzzwords in one. It was a crypto machine learning marketplace. And boy, was that a hard thing to get off the ground. It was a real struggle. It kind of felt like pushing a boulder up a hill. Every foot you move forward, you slip 5 feet back from exhaustion. It was just really hard.
I got to ask you, was this crypto machine learning marketplace, was that name or that description done to woo investors, or was it actually a product idea?
It was a product idea. The idea was that machine learning models are becoming more and more valuable. Crypto at that time felt like there was a lot of coins out there, but all of them were kind of bullshit in my mind. They never really served any underlying value. And coins needed to have value to really have a valid marketplace. And so the idea is compute was becoming more readily available, models were becoming more powerful, and there was this coin market that was exploding. And so you could have a coin that allowed you to run inferences or predictions on models, and then other people could host their own compute. So someone could say, "I have the spare computer, I'll just put it on the network and I'll make some money by allowing machine learning models to run on it." And then if you had a model, you can make money by just putting the model on the marketplace and you didn't have to worry about compute. We were a little bit ahead of our time there, but because there's now a company that's very similar, not crypto, called Hugging Face. It's doing exceptionally well. Good example of timing fit, where we were ahead on the products, on the timing, and that actually hurt us. That was a real company. Not just for the names, but also just because I thought it would like actually drive real value. But it was hard. It was really hard. And I would say like 8 months into it, I was really frustrated and I just wanted to take a break from it all. So I take a trip to Cancun. And the idea was like, I'm not going to think at all about the startup. I'm not going to think about Uber. I'm just going to relax for a week. And that's not at all what happened. My mind was racing the entire time I was there. And what I realized was that I just like, sometimes you're just not the right person for this business. Like the business could be good. It could maybe at the right time, but you're not the right person for it. And I realized that like I was never going to get this company off the ground. But I've always been inspired by other founders, kind of like how other people like track NBA players and like, ah, oh, this is how well they shoot or this is how well they dribble or whatever. I kind of do that about founders, and I kind of see them as like playing cards and such, or trading cards. And I've been really, at the time, I was really obsessed with Stuart Butterfield from Slack. And I think he's probably one of the best at the industry at failing upwards, right? He creates this video game fails, born out of that was Flickr, which becomes a big success, then goes back and says, I'm gonna create a video game for real this time, and does it again, it fails again, and born out of that was Slack, that now everyone uses and was bought by Salesforce after going public. And so I was like, how can I fail upwards here? And I started looking at all the problems that I was facing while running this project, and managing environment variables, secrets, which are just like API keys, database URLs, configuration, anything you need to configure your code at the environment level. I kept having problems with it, like a lot of different problems, all kind of from the same root. And I was trying to figure out what's going on there. And so after coming back from Cancun, I go to this dinner that Stripe was hosting called the Atlas Dinners. And they would bring in a bunch of founders and developers, and you just have great conversations. And at one point I asked the room, kind of like holding up your glass of champagne, and you like ask the room something, and I'm telling about this and this problem that I'm facing. And I'm like, hey, just be honest with me. Is the world broken or am I a shitty developer? Because I cannot tell anymore. And about 50% of them were really having problems with it. And one woman in particular, like this is the woman that really like kickstarted Doppler's journey. She comes running up to me about 30 minutes later and she says, I've had 3 outages this week. Have me a solution by Sunday. And it was a Wednesday. And I was like, no. This is going to take way longer than that to build. And she goes, I don't give a fuck. Have it by Sunday. Yeah. And I was like, okay, I hear you. I don't know if I can have it by Sunday, but I hear the pain. So right after that, I started talking to other companies. And so
I got to ask you, I have to interrupt here briefly on a few things that you mentioned that I want, that I'm sure our audience would love to understand too, is you made the statement that you knew that you weren't going to be able to get your crypto machine learning company going forward.
Yeah.
How do you avoid the trap of falling in love with your own idea and come to the realization, you know what? I thought it was a good idea. Oh, well, but it doesn't work. Call it a day. How do you get to that place? Because a lot of people fall in love with really bad ideas and they keep that. That's first question.
Yeah. I think there's
second. And there's a couple more, but if you could start there and then.
Yeah, sure. I think there's like 2 steps in this process. The first step is to like look at all the attributes of a company and see if it's like well designed enough. Like in crypto, most people didn't know how to use crypto outside of trading. Machine learning models were incredibly expensive to build, and then you'd have to have the monetization on the other side to make it worth it. To take this model that you spend millions of dollars on making and then charge a couple cents on, right? Like you really need a lot of volume there for the market to be really valid. And so there are a lot of properties of the business where, in hindsight, they just looked obvious and like, ah, the market isn't mature enough yet for this. But I think the second and that is something you'll build those skills over time. You got to fail a bunch of times at building companies to really hone those skills in. But the one that's a little bit easier to do on the first time around is every, like, I don't know, 3 months, take an emotional step back and don't see yourself as the founder of the company or the CEO of the company. And just look at yourself as like a bystander and just ask the question, is it working? Am I pushing on the market for the market to buy this, or is the market pulling me? And if the market's pulling you, you have a good product. You have product market fit. If you're pushing the market, you don't have product market fit. And if you push, and then if you're pushing in that category, then is it you're pushing a little bit slightly? Like it's kind of like, it's like if I push just a little bit, I make some money, or am I really pushing hard and no progress is happening? And the more you have to push, the worse your product market fit is. And after enough time, you basically can call it quits, right? So like I went through two cycles of that, really, like I guess 2.5, right? Because it took 8 months. So I was like 3 months, okay, it's not working. Another three and a half to 4 months, it's still not working. And then I called it quits a little bit after that. But it's really hard because you have this emotional connection.
I was going to say, I mean, that the presence of mind and the objectivity required for that decision making, it's akin to a lot of times, you know, in the mountaineering world, they talk about summit fever, and a lot of people die on the way down from Mount Everest because they lose complete sight. Oh yeah, getting up there is only halfway.
Yep.
You got to make it back too, and that's when the majority of the people get killed. And had they made the right decisions and said, you know what, today is not the day, they would be alive. Thankfully, with startups, nobody loses their life.
Thank God. The downsides are quite low.
It speaks to the emotion of it, though, right? It's you get sucked into it. And then
I get it. I would say most of the companies before, this is going to sound weird, but I think I've gotten better and better at killing bad startups. Like the first time I did a startup, I went 3 years in or 2 years in. It was like, I think 2.5 years before. And this was a tiny startup that never got, like, no one would ever be able to find on the internet. But like, it took way too long for me to kill that thing. And I feel like every startup I got faster and faster at it. And now I'm like, okay, I can know pretty quickly within 3 months if it's going to work. And a lot of times when I advise other startups, I can tell them pretty quickly, even you kind of like, you build up the almost think about like an Excel spreadsheet, and you can like have this matrix, and you can evaluate a startup based on the properties of the business. And that will kind of like push pull is one property of the business. And you just get better and better at understanding what are the properties that really make a business.
That's, of all the guests, we've never had anybody articulate it like that. So that was worth the price of admission right there.
Love it.
No one's ever actually said it that way, and I think it's a very succinct way of putting it. I'm going to steal that from you.
Do it, please. I think if they can prevent, like, if you can prevent the next entrepreneur from seven failed startups, that'd be amazing, because that was many, many years of my life.
which is actually the second question is, when you have very successfully raised money with venture capitalists now. When VCs, a lot of times, are by the numbers, how do they see seven failed attempts? I mean, was that a negative against you talking to them?
No, not at all. Not at all. They see it as a positive, right? Like, who do you want in the ring? Do you want the guy that gets punched once and doesn't get back up because it hurt too bad? Or the guy who keeps getting up and keeps taking the beating because he knows all he needs to do is land one really good punch to win the fight? That's good entrepreneurship in my mind. You cannot avoid failure. That shit's coming. That's a train that's going to hit you. But what you can do is choose to get back up and keep fighting and learn from every time and maybe get better at dodging the train. And that's how I think they saw it for me was like, and I always have this like fundamental belief in two things. One, in myself, that I'll be able to like iterate my way to success. I'll every time I get a little bit better or a lot better, at striking gold, if you will. And then the second is that I only need one win, right? It's kind of like security in the inverse way, where an attacker only needs one win and the defender needs to cover their bases. It's kind of the exact same thing in the startup world. You only need one successful startup to really make it big. Doppler is that one for me. And it took many, many years of failures, but I knew that if I just didn't give up, like the second I give up, the game's over, right? So the only choice is not to give up. That's the only logical choice if you want to play the game. And I really like playing the game.
That's, you have a huge amount of passion for it. It certainly shows through way you're putting it. But that failure, I think a lot of people look at it as a negative, and you're saying it's a train that's inevitable. I agree with you. I don't think I know of any entrepreneurs that have not failed and are not able to answer the question, where did you fail and what did you learn from it? If someone says, I've never failed, to me, that's all kinds of red flags, but I don't know what your thoughts about that are.
Yeah, I think that's a red flag because, like, if you've only had wins under your belt, you're either, like, God's gift to the world, i.e. incredibly lucky, but also you haven't learned, like, the learnings come from the failures, right? That, like, when everything's successful, like, it's easy mode, right? But, like, not every part of your journey is going to be easy. And the more, I think Jensen from, like, NVIDIA said this really well. It's like you build character through struggle, right? And you need a lot of character to build a good startup. I also think that just, like, humans by default are, like, naturally bad at two things. They're bad at exponential thinking and they're bad at evaluating risk. Like, people think really linearly. And, like, being a founder, that journey is an exponential journey, right? You can go from zero to billionaire in 3 years or 5 years, right? That's not a linear journey. And then on the other side, that's a success case. On the flip side, the negative case, the risk is, like, really low in my mind for a certain set of conditions, right? Like, if you are non-married, don't have children, low dependencies, young in your career, it's actually very, very low risk because you'll almost always end up positive from the experience, even if you fail, right? Like, think about what it takes to even just get a company off the ground, right? Think about all you had to do that. Now you've proven that you have some level of stamina, you have some level of strategic thinking, you have some level of product ideation, you've done a bunch of things that you would have never done before. Now you take it up a notch, you raise your first round of funding, a couple hundred K or 50K or something. You've now been able to raise money. To be able to raise money, you have to be good at storytelling. You have to be able to tell a good story and have a good vision. You have to build a network. You have all these things that you can lean on for the next company, right? It's not like you reset to zero like in a video game. You just stop at the place you were last at. So if you fail at pre-seed, where the company dies there, now you're a pre-seed founder and you can go raise a pre-seed again pretty easily. And then if you go and you raise a Series A, and then that's where you fail. Getting to a Series A again will not be that hard at all. Like, I could probably do it in, like, under 2 months, maybe even faster than that, depending on how the quality of the idea. And so I think that's where people get it wrong is, like, the risks are really low because you almost always come out ahead. Like, I used to hear this all the time from my friends at Uber that they're like, oh, I just need one more promotion to senior software engineer, whatever, to be able to start my company. And I'm like, dude, none of that shit matters, like, at all. The only thing that matters is getting in the ring and fighting a bit and moving forward. And every time that you get knocked down, just get back up and you're not at zero anymore. You're at the place you just lasted at, like, the last level. It's kind of like a checkpoint in a video game, right? If you die, you don't go all the way back to the very beginning of Call of Duty. You go to the last checkpoint. And that's the exact same thing in real life. And so the risks are really low in my mind.
That is, for everyone listening, take that to heart because it's very true. And you have to have the tenacity. You got to keep with it, man.
Yeah.
And that foundational belief, right? That you can do it.
You got to believe in yourself.
If you believe you can't do it, then I kind of think you're wasting your time even getting in the ring. I mean, if all you see are the odds against you, it's already over because that's a self-writing story at that point.
And I think, like, I don't know. I think if you really have the environment to do a startup, like, you're in the US and the right conditions are there, like, I think you really should do it. And especially because, like, I think humans are, like, genetically made for this, right? Like, we are predisposed to being really good at taking something from nothing to something, right? That's the reason why humanity has reached the heights it has so far is because of that ability. So it's like it's built within you. It's already there. All you have to do is being willing to trust in yourself and tap into it.
Yeah. Doppler, it's interesting that you drew upon the train analogy because anyone that's taken a fundamental physics class, Doppler physics are taught with the train analogy.
Yep.
You know, it's the sound that starts off real dim, gets real loud, and then goes dim again. That's the Doppler effect. So was that your inspiration for naming the company or where did that come from?
That was actually our inspiration for naming one of our conference rooms back when we had an office. We called it Blueshift, Redshift and Blueshift. Redshift is like Blueshift is like the future.
So you're an astronomy fan as well?
A little bit. I think space is we're all in space. Space isn't out there. We are in space. So, like, once you have that realization, it's kind of hard not to look back. It's hard to look anywhere else but forward. But no, I think the name didn't come from there. It was really a couple things. One, I wanted a name that felt familiar. And I think most people, even in like high school, are taught about some level of the Doppler effect. So there's like this familiarity presence there that I really liked. But the bigger thing was I didn't want to lock it into like what we did today. I didn't want it to be like Doppler or like the secrets management company or something like that. I wanted it to be a company that felt like you could do the best work of your career at, that you, and that the company had to keep earning its name. Right. If we slow down, we don't get to earn the name Doppler anymore. And Doppler just for me had this really unique thing of like, it's short, it's easily spelled out, it's memorable. And it feels like this is where you do the best work of your career at. And it was like that emotional connection I had to it, really, that made me choose a name.
So what is the problem set that you guys are solving? And are you experiencing a market push or a market pull? Which way are you seeing this take?
I'll answer it inverse order because I'll build up into something and super excited why I get to be on this podcast to begin with. So I would say for us, we are in pull. I would argue that the market should be pulling us a lot faster than it is, but we're still in pull mode for sure. And for us, a very easy way to like mathematically quantify that is if we just do nothing, do new customers come in every day? And the answer is yes. We get somewhere under 100 customers, somewhere between like 50 and 100 customers a day, just by doing nothing. Okay. And so that's clear pull. I would love it to be a couple thousand a day. That would be the dream, right? But, it's still pull. But yeah, the reason why I came on this podcast and is because I'm actually here to do a PSA. For anyone listening, if you work at a company in a security position or an engineering position, or you're a CEO and executive, this is the PSA for you. In short, what I'm here to talk about are something called secrets. And the backstory of why secrets matter is that the everyday person, me, you, and everyone else listening, uses more and more services every day. We use Netflix, we use DoorDash, we use Venmo. And those services and services like them are getting breached every single day. And there's a real impact to that, to both the company and to the people that are trusting those companies with their data. And a little background about what a secret is, because I know that's like a fancy term that doesn't really mean much until you have that background knowledge. So a secret is a piece of data that is highly sensitive. It shouldn't be out in the public. It should only be for that company to use and see. And that secret generally is like a key to a door. And behind that door is a bunch of data. And so you can think about it if like you go to Airbnb, right? Airbnb has a database, and that database has a bunch of listings, a bunch of payments, transactions, and such. And all that's under that database are a set of databases. And to get access to that database, you need that key, typically called a database URL or an API key. And those are secrets. And you can imagine if the key is out on the internet, open for anyone to see, like a hacker, right? They can go into that database and steal all the data out of it. And that's really scary for both the company and the people that trust Airbnb or whatever company that gets hacked to use. And like, there's tons of examples in the industry today about this.
Well, let me ask you the dumb question then. How is this different from a LastPass or another password manager?
Great question. Yeah, this is a really, really important difference between us, or secrets management, or secrets and passwords. Passwords are for humans. They are like, I have a Netflix password, and that is only for my account on Netflix.
Okay.
Secrets are not like that at all. Secrets are for passwords for companies, generally for software. And that one secret gives you access to everyone's Netflix, everyone's Venmo, everyone's Airbnb, everyone's DoorDash. It is the one key to the entire data kingdom, all of it. And these pieces of text are no longer than a password. A lot of times they're even shorter than a password. And there's thousands of them within a company. And it only takes one of these secrets to get out for there to be incredible costs to both people and company. I can talk about those costs. They're quite massive from like a company's perspective.
Sure. But if we centralize them all, playing devil's advocate here.
Sure.
Because I'm sure you have an answer for this and I'm eager to hear it. When you centralize them all into the Doppler ecosystem, then all I got to do is hack Doppler.
That is true.
Now I really have everything.
Yes, it's partially true. So we offer something called Enterprise Key Management. And the idea there is that a customer can connect their AWS, GCP, or Azure account to Doppler and use their own encryption keys. So even if you were able to hack Doppler, you still don't have those encryption keys. That comes from the customer. And you need to be able to hack AWS, GCP, or Azure to get that. So there's like layers of protections in place. Also, the place that Doppler stores those secrets is not accessible by the internet. It's like very far removed from the internet and very locked down. So it'd be very hard for a company to breach that. But let's just say they did breach that. They got all through all of our walls of defense. Okay. We double encrypt the data. We encrypt it once with our encryption key per customer. And then we also use the customer's encryption key. So now you need to breach AWS or GCP twice, or sometimes maybe even AWS and GCP, depending on what cloud provider we're on and the customer's on. So there's layers and layers of defense there that really kind of like silo each customer's secrets to them by themselves. So there's a level of data isolation that should protect those customers. So we have over 50,000 companies using us today. We fend off attacks every single day, and we haven't been breached. And I think we do a pretty good job of it because of the security architecture we built.
Wow. So, and you're very much taking, what would be a good example? An API key from Stripe. Would that be an example
of a... Yeah, that'd be a great example of it. Yeah. Before we get too much into solution territory, because I really don't want this to be an hour podcast on Brian pitching Doppler. That's not the point of this here. The point of this is to really, for anyone listening, to understand that you probably do have this gap and what are the costs of this gap, right? Like, so from a company's perspective, if you have a data breach, there's brand reputation, right? Like, think about Equifax and how much that's tarnished their brand. You could lose customers from it. You'll probably have a lot of unplanned spend because now you have legal issues and PR issues and insurance premiums increases. Your team's going to be focused on fixing this breach instead of shipping new product. If you're big enough or in a regulated industry, the government could step in and say, "Hey, we got to add some more regulation scrutiny to it." Mispronounce that big time. And there's litigation risk, right? Like if you're not protecting your secrets, which are the literal keys to the data kingdom, you're negligent. And that is totally valid for companies to go and sue you for. And then on the people side, I think it's so easy. This is something I see all the time that is very frustrating for me, is I see companies talk about data as data. It's just like this, like, oh yeah, we have data and we store data and we have terabytes of data. But it's like that data is from people. Right? People are trusting Uber, Netflix, and so on, and all these services. That's real people's data. That's my data. That's your data.
Yes.
And when that data gets out, it hurts real people. And I can tell you a real story. I got a call. So I live in Austin, and I brought my mom out for a weekend, and we were going in at this barbecue joint. And while we were at this barbecue joint, I get a call, and it's from this spam caller, but at the time I didn't know that. They're claiming to be from the customs, like Texas Customs. And they're like, "Hey, we have this package that's in your name, that has illegal drugs in it and illegal money in it. And we're investigating you." And they start rattling off a bunch of facts that like no one should have known about. There were easy ones like my addresses, but there was stuff that clearly was from a data breach. And it felt so real in the moment. And remember, I'm a CEO, I'm a target, but like I know this is happening to a lot of other people right now. And they were able to make it feel so credible because there was a data breach from another company. My data got exposed and they were able to use that to get even more data out of me. I accidentally leaked one more piece of data that I shouldn't have. And I'm sure the next time they try to attack me, they'll use that data. And so it's really important to remember that this data that companies are charged with protecting is real people's data that has real consequences when it gets out. Not just some extra burn for the company or some bad PR, but real people are impacted by it. And so it's really important that we protect those secrets. So that's the PSA. We can go into like why this is happening and how to solve
it. Yeah, I was going to say, foundationally, is it not happening because we've traded convenience for security?
Yes. Right. I think there's two parts to it. One is there is a lack of knowledge, which I'm trying to fix right now, around secrets. Like there is, I would say that the entire software development industry and DevOps industry is quite mature. There's a lot of robust tooling across the board. But one of the few things that people just have like not really invested in is secrets management. Like they're like, oh, I have these API keys, I put it in this file and I'm good, right? And it works. And they're only thinking about it from the it works mentality, like, oh, my server stays up or my developers can keep coding, not from the implications of just one of these pieces of text in this huge file of keys gets out, the whole company just got fucked and all the customers got fucked. Sorry for the language, but it's true.
No, well, that's pretty much the right description.
I think the last time I looked, I have like, I've been in 17 data breaches or something like that. It's like, whoa, that number is way too freaking high. Way, way too high. Companies need to be doing a better job. And it's not that hard to solve it, which I'll get into in a second. Actually, this is the thing that I've learned the most from my time at Doppler, is that the bigger the company, the more, the worse their security posture is. And the reason why is because you really need to bake security into the company and into the product day one. If you just slap it on as an add-on, like, now is the time that we need to care about security, you're never going to do a good job. And remember, you need to cover all your bases as a defender. Attacker only needs one entry point. They just need one. And there could be millions of entry points if you have millions of secrets, right? And there's kind of like three questions I like to ask companies. And this really is like the nuts and bolts of it. If a company cannot answer these three questions, they have a very serious problem on their hands. And it's not a matter of if they're going to get hacked. It's just a matter of when, in my mind. And very simple questions. Where are all my secrets, right? Are they, what? Literally every piece of secret, where are they? Are they in production infrastructure? Are they on developers' laptops? Are they on past employee laptops? Like, where are all those secrets? Do contractors have them? Who has access to them, right? And then can I stop a data breach when it happens, right? If like your password gets out and your API key gets out in the public, can you quickly remediate that without bringing yourself down? I'll tell you a real story. We had a customer come to us, and I can't say the name, but I promise you know the name of this customer. You probably have used their tool on a daily basis or their product on a daily basis. And they told us that they had a data breach where someone actually inside the company was like an implanted spy and stole the secrets and left and sold on the black market. And when that happened, they obviously every single secret now, because when a data breach happens, you don't say, that one secret that got out is now vulnerable. You say every secret's vulnerable because we don't know what our risk exposure is. We don't know how bad the problem is yet. And so they decided, rightfully so, that they had to what's called rotate. You swap out the locks, right? You say this key is bad and void, and this new key is valid and working. So you do a rotation. And they said they had to rotate 15,000 secrets. It took their team of three security engineers, 6 months to rotate every secret. That was 6 months of the roadmap that just got reallocated on a dime. That was 6 months of engineering headcount, security headcount that went out the window. And that was 6 months of risk of further attacks happening because the window for an attack was still open. Right? That's how bad this gets. When this bomb goes off, it's not like, I'm fixing and I'm done. It's like, if you don't have the right tools in place before the attack happens, you're now in a manual process of playing this game of, I need to swap out the keys to the kingdom while also not bringing the company down in the process, which means you have to do it very slowly, which gives the attacker the advantage because now they have all the time in the world to basically use those keys to attack you.
And Brian, see, if you bring this up into the beginning of the development cycle, it becomes that classical problem where most dev teams are under a time crunch to deliver an MVP by an X date. And the easiest thing to deep six is QA time. And what's even more easier is to hell with the security.
Yep.
Right. I mean, look at Zoom. At least they came out and they went clean about this. We never had that in mind when we did it, but that is a classical thing, and it happens every single day. And how do you get then to these decision makers who have little understanding of a development cycle, and what they're asking is potentially a compromise of their brand, of legal and financial losses, of regulatory fines, loss of revenue and customers? They don't see it that way, right? How do you make it a tangible connection? What are your thoughts?
I think there's two. So we usually get customers from two different points of view. The first point of view is the security side. They've kind of like grown the business enough where they realize, we built something valuable. We need to protect it now. And like that sale is pretty easy. It's like, but that's not the question you had at hand. I think the other side is that there's this misnomer in the industry that security comes at the cost of productivity. And I would say for a lot of tools, that's absolutely true. All of our competitors, that's true. The one thing that really makes Doppler very unique in the industry, and I hope that other companies copy this, either our competitors or even just other verticals of security, is that the right security tool makes everyone more productive too, right? I kind of like to think about it as like making vegetables taste like candy. If you make the vegetables taste like candy, people will want to eat it every day.
Yep.
And so we spent a lot of time doing that. And so the second side people come to us is they're like, hey, we have all these secrets all over the place, and that's causing production outages, that's causing loss of developer time, and we need to make the productivity problems go away so our developers can get back to writing code. And that's the other side of it, that where we get customers from. I think it's really hard. What we found is that it's really, really hard to basically convince someone who doesn't think there's a problem that there's actually a problem. We've tried a whole bunch of different ways, but it's very hard because it's like you don't think it's a problem. And that's what I'm trying to solve here with this PSA. It's like and I'm not saying go buy Doppler, right? You could go buy someone else. I mean, I'd love it if you buy Doppler. Hopefully I've proven that I'm an honest, trustworthy person, but like, and so is the company. But even if you don't pick us, go solve the problem, because like, I probably have my data in your systems, right? And like, I don't want another data breach. And I'm pretty sure everyone else doesn't want another data breach. But I think the right tools make it really easy. This is, you're seeing this across the board in security these days, like Wiz or Doppler, where it doesn't take that long to get the win in, right? With Doppler, a small company can get a win in a day. An enterprise can get it in 2 to 4 months, sometimes even faster, depending on their operational capabilities. It doesn't take that long. To have the right tools in place. And if you buy the right tools, they actually make your developers more productive. So you actually get two wins there, right? The company's more secure, which is like, you can think about Doppler as like an insurance policy on your business. That's really how you should think about security, is like as insurance, right? If something goes wrong, you can unfuck yourself really quickly.
Yeah. Well, actually, in the cyber liability world, that's not holding true very much, but that's a whole, we could do an entire show about that.
Okay.
Unfortunately, some of our best customers have come to us after the horse left the barn.
Yep.
Right. Or they are educated. They have, through experiences, maybe not in their current format, but in prior formats, understood that not addressing the security issue is a potential death knell for the company. And I can tell you, in the SMB world, Brian, 6 months post breach, the majority of SMB companies are out of business.
Yep, 100% true. They just don't have enough working capital to like give them the runway to recover from that. I mean, it's where like the strong survive and the weak die off. It's like that. If you didn't protect yourself, if you didn't build the shield from the obvious attacker that's incoming, then you're going to get taken out by the arrow, right? And like, the arrow is the hack. And so in my mind, it's like, if you want to build a company that's worth anything, then you have to protect it from it being destroyed. And the very obvious solution here is to add some security on. That's the whole point of security.
Brian, where does open source, how does that play a role in this? Because you're borrowing those libraries as a developer. You don't know.
Yeah,
I mean,
open source in my mind is very complicated because there's lots of different dimensions to open source. I think from a purely a security lens, open source is a good thing. It's because as long as those packages are audited, then it's, you have more eyes on it than not, right? But I do think that there's like, they run the risk of supply chain attacks, right? Now Doppler does something, and I think most companies should be doing this, is it's called package freezing. And basically what we say is we audit every package that we use internally, and then we freeze it and we say, we're only gonna use that package, and all of its dependencies are frozen too. So if there is a supply chain attack, we get we watch the vulnerability channels. So we'll be like, okay, a vulnerability is now popped up for a package in a future version than our current package, and we handle that before we basically bump up the version. And then on our most precious parts of the infrastructure, like what we call our token server, which encrypts and stores the secrets, that has no dependencies. The only dependency it has is Golang, which is converted into a binary. So like the dependencies are very low. So like it's not subject to a supply chain attack outside of Go itself being breached. And then somehow it's like an old breach or like an old vulnerability that then is subject to being able to attack our binary, right? Like there's a lot of things that would have to happen for that attack to work. But it's a real problem. Like, I'm glad there's companies that exist now that like really watch closely, like the open source community, because it's like, it's very easy for like imagine if you're like a well-funded attacker. It's very easy to go to someone who has this package that's been around for 15 years, extremely dependent on, has probably like 15, 20 million weekly downloads on NPM, and say, hey, I'm going to offer you $100,000 for this. And they go, oh shit, payday of all paydays. Then in the next version, they just sneak in a little attack, and that package is used 20 million times a week by other packages. So like you think you're downloading React, but you're actually downloading 50 other packages along with React because React needs those packages. And boom, now you've been hit by the attack. So it's very, very real. But it kind of like, I think the benefits outweigh the costs if managed properly.
Where do you think, and it's obligatory for me to ask this, so I'll apologize. I really don't, I'm kind of tired of hearing the term machine learning and AI, but because it's been, it seems like you can't, even the toilet flushing mechanism has AI in it now for some reason. But where do you think AI, how is that going to impact what you're doing at Doppler and in terms of secrets management? And let's go one step further. If you were looking into the mid-range future, where does quantum computing, does it affect what you're going to do?
Yeah, both are going to affect everything. I think in the same dimension, which is, again, attacker needs one entry point to win. Right. And then the defender has to cover all their bases. And AI is just going to make the attacks more sophisticated, presenting entry points that weren't even thought of before. Right. And quantum computing is just going to increase your ability to try multiple attacks at the same time. And they'll also be able to like break the current encryption standards. Like I think the whole world is going to have a huge issue when quantum computing becomes readily available, because like AES 256 cannot withstand a quantum computer. Like that will break AES 256 is like basically the default encryption standard for like almost every company, right? Like SSL is built on that and a bunch of others. And so like if that gets broken, all encryption today will get broken and all private data is essentially public data.
You have the keys now. You can reverse the keys for everything.
Yeah. Right? And so like I think what will need to happen is like we basically wrap. We have a new encryption standard will need to be quantum safe, and we'll need to wrap all the existing encryption keys with the new quantum safe protocol. And basically we need to protect all the old and then produce only new quantum safe encryption keys going forward. And so I think the industry needs to get ahead of that now. Like we need to be doing that now because we have no idea when quantum computing is going to become readily available. It's already starting to become more and more available, but when it becomes super readily available where you could just like spin up an instance on AWS, that's going to be scary. And same thing with like AI. AI is just going to find more entry points, and it definitely is going to make it harder for every business, Doppler and every other security business, every other business on the planet, every business that needs security, which I'd argue every business does. AI is going to make the problem a lot harder. And so it's better to get ahead of it now.
Now, I think with the quantum computing, you've described the problem that's going to create an industry. If you remember back at the YG days, nobody cared about it until it was inevitable. I have a feeling the way human nature is, no one's going to care about this until it's inevitable. And then all of a sudden, there will be massive consulting houses that will offer services to.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this one's really interesting because like I think both AI and quantum computers, it's the best models and the best quantum computers will be held by the companies with the most resources. And so there is a strategic advantage there for actually acting in the shadows, right? Like instead of going and every company gets hacked on day one and then every company goes, oh fuck, and updates all their crypto keys overnight, Right. It's better for them just to be able to, like, and I'm not saying any company in particular is going to do this or any nation states in particular is going to do this, but whoever has those, they're strategically advantaged to just like hacking companies quietly and companies trying to figure out how the fuck did my encryption get broken. And then they're going to, and then they may realize years later, oh, it was with a quantum computer. And this will just happen in the shadows for a long enough period of time where they have such a strategic advantage that it makes sense for them to open up about it, or the industry to become aware of it. So I think there's not going to be like one big doomsday with AI and quantum. I think it's just going to be a lot of attacks that are very targeted and strategic that are going to be very, I guess, like flawlessly executed. And so it's going to be really big attacks, very infrequent, that it's going to make it very hard to figure out, is it actually a quantum attack? Is it an AI attack? Or is this just a gap we had in our existing security posture?
Well, Brian, we're at the hour. I wanted to make sure that we gave you a little bit of time here to plug whatever it is that you'd like to plug. You know, if you, any call outs, anything, let our audience, anything you want them to know about.
Anything okay. So you're up to. I'll keep it very simple for everyone in the audience so they can stop listening to me. I'm going to give you a quick smoke test, and this is going to tell you if you have a fire. And okay. Basically, can you answer these three questions? Where are all my secrets? Who has access to them? And can I stop a data breach when it happens? If you can't answer those three, you need a secrets manager. It doesn't have to be Doppler. I'd like you to use Doppler, but it doesn't have to be us. And a good secrets manager should do the following things. It should centralize all your secrets so that you know where all your secrets are that you have to protect. Give you the ability to manage who has access to them. Give you auditing tools to know when they were accessed. It should natively integrate in your infrastructure. So when you make a change, it updates in your infrastructure so you don't have outages. And gives you the ability to remediate a breach quickly when it happens. If one of our customers has a data breach, they can fix the problem in under 5 minutes, right? Versus 6 months. So if any of that feels familiar to you, or you feel those pain points, I strongly recommend going to doppler.com/unfuck, UNFUCK. And that will give you a walkthrough of what we've been talking about on this podcast and give you the early links to go to start learning about how to solve the problem.
If someone wants to reach out to you, Brian, what's the best method?
Brian, B-R-I-A-N @doppler.com. I always respond to emails. Just put that you saw me from or heard me from this podcast, and I'll respond as quickly as I can.
You're phenomenal, Brian. Love the enthusiasm, sage advice on the entrepreneurship front, on the secrets management front. Keep doing what you're doing. I think you're making us all a little bit more secure, which is the mission that we're on. So appreciate all the work.
I appreciate you hosting us and having this podcast, and everyone who's gone this far and listening to the podcast and hearing us rant for an hour. I really appreciate you too. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, everyone. And don't forget to like and subscribe so that we can keep producing this content. It matters, people. You know, like, subscribe, download, tell your friends about it. It helps us out. So appreciate it. Take care, everyone. Until next week.